Why are graven images forbidden by the Torah? Why is the Torah so concerned with idolatry? You might think that it is because God has no image, and any image of God is therefore a distortion. But Heschel read the commandment differently. No, he said, it is precisely because God has an image that idols are forbidden. You are the image of God. But the only medium in which you can shape that image is that of your entire life. To take anything less than a full, living, breathing human being and try to create God's image out of it, that diminishes the divine, and that is considered idolatry. You can't make God's image. You can only be God's image.
What do you think idolatry is? Someone asked me in the lobby a few months ago, and the seed of this sermon was born. What is idolatry? My short answer is it's mistaking something that is not ultimate for that which is ultimate. So let me unpack this for a moment. My starting point is the theologian Paul Tillich. He used the term ultimate concern to describe faith. He said, we focus our faith on that which is of ultimate concern to us. And for me, that understanding of faith as ultimate concern is the launching pad for how I approach spirituality. I believe that our individual spirituality is our relationship to that which is of ultimate concern to us. Okay, that can all be a little bit abstract and non-visual. So for those who need to kind of get a picture in the mind, here's the picture that I use. It's picturing the individual spiritual life as a giant wheel. And at the center of the wheel, the hub, is whatever concerns you ultimately, the thing that's most important. The thing in the hub really can be just about anything. God, love, money, nature, booze, drugs, flag, patriotism, sex, gambling, status, you name it, the list goes on. And then the spokes of the wheel are all the things that make up our lives, the different aspects, our bodies, our mind, our emotions. And so how those move is very much connected with what's at the center. So of this, I'm sure, whatever is at the center has a huge impact on our lives. If it's love at the center, for example, we're going to live our lives in a really different way than if sex is at the center of the wheel. I would argue that some of the things that we put in the center are worthy and constructive, and other things are not. So, sure, money, drugs, booze, nationalism, these things can be an ultimate concern for us, but I don't think they're worthy of being at the center. And idolatry is having the wrong thing in the center. So to me, it's a really useful term for labeling when we put something wrong in the center of our lives. Something that's not constructive, something that's not helpful, something that's not life-giving. Idolatry is a concept that many religions in the world utilize. A lot of us are most familiar with it through Judaism and through Christianity, but they're not the only religions that use it. Certainly, the concept of idolatry is big in the Hebrew Bible, starting with its notable presence in the Ten Commandments. That litany of thou shalt nots includes, thou shalt not make unto me any graven image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or that is in the earth beneath or that is in the water under the earth. Thou shalt not bow down thyself to them nor serve them. And it's important with Judaism to understand that that came to be in a place where there was lots of polytheistic religious understandings. In its strong prohibition against worshiping images, staked out Judaism as something different. From the Hebrew Bible, the most famous example of idolatry is the golden calf incident in Exodus. Yeah, and if Charlton Heston's picture just flashed in your mind, you're not alone. So the story goes like this. The people of Israel have been lost, wandering in the wilderness after their dramatic escape from Egypt. They are tired and they're hungry and they're feeling hopeless of ever finding their way to their destination. They are feeling so forlorn that they actually begin to wish they were back in Egypt, back in the enslaved situation there, because they had security and certainty and food there. Well, meanwhile, Moses is off communing with God, I guess, on Mount Sinai, and the people lose all hope then of his return. In his absence, the priest Aaron orders the people to bring him their jewelry in the midst, and then he takes the metal of that jewelry to construct this golden calf and invites the people to worship this calf. Of course, in the midst of the worship, Moses returns. He's got the Ten Commandments from God in hand, the tablets, and seeing this idolatry, he flings the tablets in anger at the ground, breaking them apart. He takes the golden calf, burns it, grounds the remains into powder, sprinkles the remains in water, and then forces the people to drink that. Only the beginning of the punishment for the idolatry. So it's a pretty good story, and it is vivid in my mind, maybe from that movie. But I like the prophets in the Hebrew Bible and their take on idolatry even more. They take it a step further. For the prophets, idolatry is not just lifting up some image as the whole of the divine, like a golden calf, but it also can be found in the form of injustice. Stop running from other gods, or running after other gods, the prophet Jeremiah warns his people. But he also says, mend your ways. Deal fairly with one another. Do not oppress the alien, the orphan, the widow. Shed no innocent blood in this holy land. So he and the other prophets are saying to Israel, the way you're behaving is taking what's not should not be of ultimate concern and putting that in the center, and that's making you not behave well. The proof's in your actions. Actions like not caring for the widow, not caring for the orphan, not caring for the stranger. So they cajole the people to replace this inadequate thing at the hub of the wheel of their spirituality with something that is better, more life-giving. In the stirring words of Amos, let justice roll down like a river and righteousness flow like an ever-flowing stream. And then the Christian scriptures pick up this understanding of idolatry. Paul, for example, warns one of the churches in his letters that indecency and foul cravings and ruthless greed are all nothing less than idolatry. Mend your ways, Paul says, echoing the great prophets of the Hebrew Bible. Live, he tells them, as if Jesus' message of love your neighbor, as if you really believe that. Live as if you really do love your neighbor as yourself. Regardless of whether your neighbor is a Jew or Gentile, slave or free person, male or female. Well, I find this concept of idolatry in the spirit of the Hebrew prophets to be a really helpful tool in the spiritual journey. And what I really like about it is that the prophets focus not on other communities, other people, and where they were idolatrous, but they focused on their own people, their own community, their own nation. The concept of idolatry kind of got a bad rap when people used it to hurl at other people that didn't believe the way they do. I think it's much better used as a self-referential idea. How am I doing? What's at the center of my life? So my purpose today is not to use this concept to attack other people, but to use it to reflect on us, on the fellowship, on Unitarian Universalism, on me. And the question is, what lies at the center of our faith, and is it worthy of us? And what are the false idols we tend to lift up? So I've got a bunch that came to mind. I was actually surprised at how easy this was. The first one is reason. So we Unitarian Universalists have historically rejected emotion or gut feelings or what we often label as superstition or magic as ways to figure out our beliefs. We have minds. We ought to use them when it comes to matters of faith, we say. So we don't ask people to check their minds at the door when they come in. This makes sense to me, but I think we can go too far and make an idol of reason. Sometimes we actually do seem to ask people to check their emotions at the door. Don't want those. Let's keep it logical, rational. No tears. That's idolatry, I think. And when that happens, then our services become dry. They become ultimately irrelevant, in my view. So, and in the Fox Valley, there's plenty of places to go have conversations like that. We've got lots of universities in this area, and they do that stuff well. We do something different. And what I think we do is we invite all of you in. Your mind, yes, don't check that at the door, but also your emotions, your body, your experiences, all those are welcome here. This is not a head game. And so our faith is not ultimately about reason alone. Reason is a tool we use in exploring our faith and developing our faith. That's why we don't check our minds at the door. But the purpose of this place is not to exercise our minds. It's just a tool. Another common false idol in Unitarian Universalism is individualism and personal freedom. This is probably the one I've fallen most into. Yes, we do value the individual. We affirm the freedom of individual conscience. This is why we don't have a creed, a common statement that we all have to buy into. But individuality and freedom, that's not what this is all about either. And when we make an idol of these things, well, we have no boundaries. The individual group becomes the king. Anything and everything become acceptable. Your journey makes you embrace neo-Nazism? Great, come on in. You're welcome here because you can believe whatever you want here. How many times have we heard people describe this place like that? You can believe whatever you want here. We'll tolerate your ideas. You have a need to dominate a small group or even the whole congregation or to make your personal pathology everybody's pathology? Fine, come on in. Have at us. You validate your beliefs by trashing everyone else's? Great, come on in. You're welcome here. You can do that. This is the spirit of Unitarian Universalist congregations who have made an idol of individuality and personal freedom. And there are plenty of such congregations. They tend to be destructive, dysfunctional, and dying. The truth is that our congregations do have very wide circles around what is acceptable. We don't rigidly enforce boundaries. We value individuality and freedom. We tolerate a whole bunch. But in the end, we actually do have boundaries. There are some things which are just not acceptable because they're so contrary to the spirit of our faith, for example, to our embrace of the inherent dignity and worth of all people. Neo-Nazism goes against that. And there's some things that are not acceptable because they're so destructive to the fabric of community. We have boundaries. We need boundaries. And when we draw them, we should do so in a way that's democratic and humble. No doubt we'll draw them imperfectly, but draw them we must. Not rigid and tight, out of ways, but they've got to be there. Next on my list is kind of the opposite of that, Community. Don't get me wrong, I love community. It's one of the central understandings, pillars of my faith. I believe that most of us, certainly me included, do better in the company of others in our spiritual journey. I find a great deal of meaning and support and inspiration and challenge by relating with all of you in this community. I wouldn't be the same person without this community. In fact, sometimes I think this community has saved my life. But community isn't what it's all about either. The community can be wrong. Community is fallible. It's made up of human beings, and guess what? We're fallible. Community can be fallible. Community can be ultimately unhealthy. And so while it's really important, community is not at the center of Unitarian Universalism on its own, in my view. My next two potential false idols of Unitarian Universalism are also opposites. The first is harmony, the need to all get along. When we put harmony at the middle, we flatten our differences, we paper them over, we pretend we're all the same, and when this happens, our congregations become shallow, unfocused, and ultimately boring. But the more common idol in Unitarian Universalism is actually disharmony, which is when we lift up the truth that we can get somewhere in our understanding by exposing ourselves to the disagreement. But when we lift that up and say, that is the only way to the truth, then our congregations can become antagonistic debate societies. And I would lift up that doesn't really work. I think many smaller UU congregations in the last 60 years have gone that route. It's a huge turnoff to most people. It's unidimensional. It just doesn't work on its own. Next on my list of potential UU idols, the seven principles. Now, these aren't what it's all about either. For those that aren't familiar, I think they're printed in the order of service, at least most weeks we do. I meant to look this week. And don't get me wrong, I like the seven principles. I think they're helpful. I use them a lot, but they are not the be-all and end-all of Unitarian Universalism. We had a UU 101 class this morning, and the seven principles came up, and I talked about them, that they came to be in the mid-1980s as a snapshot of what was most important to many Unitarian Universalists in 1985. So they're instructional. I think it was actually a good process that created them, but they are not a creed. They're not a belief statement that we have to embrace and recite. They're a snapshot. I think probably that today we'd say pretty much the same thing. Will we in 100 years? I doubt it. I don't think we'll have exactly those. It's just a snapshot. My final two potential false idols are more particular to this congregation. The first is numerical and financial growth. This fellowship has grown a lot numerically and financially in the last 30 years. But this growth is not what it's ultimately about. It's a byproduct of services and programs that are helping people figure out their spiritual path. It's a byproduct of a mostly healthy and dynamic congregation. It's a byproduct of making a difference as a community and beyond our walls in the Fox Valley. So we don't embrace growth because it puts more bodies in the seats or more money in the coffers. We embrace growth because we think there's people out there who might want to be here and have their lives enriched, changed, transformed, saved by being here. So if we forget that fact and we focus on the numbers, on the money, that's idolatry. We've made an idol of growth. And finally, we could make an idol here of our success. We have grown beyond the wildest dreams of most UU congregations, especially in smaller, conservative Midwest cities where we're not supposed to do that well. But we make an idol of that success we have enjoyed if we start sort of reveling in it, if we start overlooking the things we don't do very well, and there's plenty of those, we'll lose our growing edge, our dynamism, if we start focusing on what we've done that's successful, because then we'll just try to replicate it. We won't want to change. We'll try to stay the same. What we'll end up is being a hubristic, smug, self-satisfied congregation, and that's a recipe to go down. So what I'd like to invite you to do today and in the coming weeks is to contemplate three spiritual questions. One is, what is at the hub of your life? The second one is whatever is at the hub worthy of your life? Is it worthy of being there? And third, if you look as objectively as possible at the way you're living your life, does that hub get reflected? Let me say a word about that last question. Spirituality is not about what we say we believe. It's about how we actually live our lives. So we all know the Hollywood character, the fiction character who lifts up, God is first in my life, family's first, but lives as if money's first. Well, the statement about what's first isn't worth a hill of beans. What matters is how we live our lives. So I think that last question is incredibly important. The three questions again. What's at the hub of the spiritual wheel of your life? Is that thing at the hub worthy of being there? And is it clear that what you say is at the center of your life is, in fact, at the center?